Welcome to Season 4 of Blackness in the Workplace, the podcast. Our mission, as always, is to empower Black professionals by providing resources, guidance, and support within a safe space to speak truth to power about the uniqueness of our shared experiences and identities. Here at Blackness in the Workplace, we believe in centering, promoting, building, and supporting Black professionals both inside and outside the workplace. Our voices matter, our lives matter, our experiences matter. I'm your host and your advocate, Jessica. So let's get this conversation started. All right, everyone, welcome to this episode of Blackness in the Workplace. Again, I am your host, Jessica. I have with me for our third time, Dr. Kimya Nuhr-Dennis. If you have been listening to our podcast from Jump Street, she was our very first guest. She was on season 2 for a Real Talk episode. I really, really appreciate this woman's point of view, her energy, and I like having her on. So she is on again for our series on education. She has an amazing background. So I'm going to read her bio again for those of you who are new. But for those of you who have been listening to the podcast, you definitely know who I'm talking about. But Dr. Dennis is an activist. She is a sociologist, a criminologist, educator, and researcher. She is the founder of 365 Diversity, where she provides results-based services for decision makers in K-12 schools, colleges and universities, businesses, for-profit and nonprofit organizations. Her emphasis is placed on supporting and protecting people's underserved and minoritized identities and experiences in their personal and professional lives. A range of demographics and cultures that she works with consists of religion, spirituality, race, ethnicity, gender, socioeconomic status, language and communication, mental health, physical health, self-harm, suicide, disability, reproductive decisions, and sexuality. So she covers a lot. She was born and raised in Virginia, and she lived in North Carolina for 17 years. 8 of those years was in Raleigh to attain her doctorate, and 9 of those years was in Winston-Salem as a college and faculty advisor and staff, she currently lives in Baltimore, Maryland, and she connects with local, national, and international schools, businesses, and organizations. And if you follow her on Twitter, you get more of her flavor, more of who she is. So without further ado, Dr. Dennis.
Thank you so much. And I always appreciate you being open to these discussions and contributing and making changes. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. So again, great to have you and, you know, get your unfiltered opinion, you know, how it is about what's going on in the world. And so for this series, we're definitely going to be talking about, you know, I say this is education, but we have people on that's going to be talking about a variety of subjects. You have a very strong background in academia. So I want to kind of talk about how did you get into that? Why did you get into that? And then we can go from there.
All right. So I always wanted to be some form of an educator. And so that's, you know, so I'm also trained in music. So even doing music, singing, playing the harp, playing the piano, I still wanted to do some form of teaching and knowledge development. And so I started teaching college students in 2004 when I was in the doctoral program. And throughout that, then I finished the doctorate, I became full-time faculty, and then I achieved tenured associate professor. And then in 2019, I moved to Baltimore City and I decided to leave full-time academia, so no longer full-time academia. And with all of that said, when I talk about being an educator, I've done presentations for students in high schools, in community work, do presentations and trainings for mental and health professionals. And the whole focus for me is to reduce the falsehoods that are taught, learned, and perpetuated. So in my lifetime, I do my best to remove falsehoods. And falsehoods will always exist as long as humans exist for tens of thousands of years, but we can do our part to increase truth. And that's very important because a lot of times people misconstrue the meaning of personal belief from actual facts. And they think that pushing facts is forcing them to believe certain things. And I tell them, you are welcome to believe whatever you want. We're not changing your thoughts and beliefs. But we're saying when you come into other spaces, you cannot claim that that's factual. And also you cannot use false information to harm other people's lives. So that's what I focus on.
Yeah, facts over feelings for sure.
And there's feelings in there. I mean, there's also feelings and facts. So when I talk about health disparities and problems with police departments, there's definitely feelings in there. As Black people, particularly Black women, we don't have to pretend that we're unemotional, because white people, despite tens of thousands of years of sciences, mathematics, knowledges, arts, literatures, we're taught in most K through 12 and most colleges, including terminal degrees around the world, that white people created everything that's worth knowing, that white people are the rational, logical decision makers, especially white men and cisgender heterosexual, but whiteness and white supremacy surpasses gender and sexuality and health conditions as well. And so we're literally taught to legitimize our knowledge, expertise, and intellect. We have to pretend to be robots and aliens to impress white people.
Yeah.
Like, white people want us to smile like Shuck and Jive, step and fetch it. But then white people want us to have this stoic face to prove that we are unemotional, rational thinkers worthy of European white version of knowledge. And I don't fall into that. When I was a doctoral student, I fell into that more, because going to all these criminology, criminal justice, health conferences and so forth, it was basically a bunch of white people. And it was hard to know how to maneuver that. And then I just had to become more knowledgeable. And I tell Black people this every day, W.B. Du Bois' double consciousness does not mean to be a token sellout. Neither does code switching. I'm tired of Black people talking about, I'm code switching. No, you're selling out. Completely different thing.
Respectability politics is kind of what a lot of Black people still practice.
Yes. And and they pretend that that's what they're told to do. And so, you know, we don't have time to go through all of it, but I will say a lot of the tension that I have in the work I do is actually not with white people, because white people have figured out how to start doing things anonymously. It's the Black people who defend white people where a lot of tension comes in, and they pretend that they're doing it for a larger cause, you know, that includes Black politicians. It's the same thing for centuries. It's you know, just like when Black folk helping the slave owners, it's all pretending there's a larger purpose, when Black people are telling you your larger purpose is being defined by white people. You need to listen to our people. We're telling you the larger purpose. So that's why I just tell Black people, instead of saying you're doing something for a larger purpose, admit that you're doing something because you care about your career the most. You care about paying your bills the most.
Yep.
And no matter what Black people are saying is the problem, all you care about is whether white liberals agree and whether white conservatives get angry and might terminate you.
Yeah.
So the work that I do encompasses all of that, because that's the full span of humans for thousands of years.
Wow. That's I mean, you said a lot right there. I mean, there are a lot of Black people who are gatekeepers to white people. It's one of the ways that it works, that you have to have some Black people who are kind of those gatekeepers caping for white folks and making sure that other Black people stay in line. It's, you know, it's always been set up that way. And so you're saying that even in academia, it's set up in those ways where you have Black people who are very sensitive to white people, don't want to hurt white feelings, and doing that to really protect themselves and help advance what they want to do.
Yeah, white power and white terrorism is the same everywhere. It doesn't vary by occupation. It doesn't vary by education level. It doesn't vary by political party. It doesn't vary by who you vote for. It doesn't vary by who's in political office. And a lot of people have this misconstrued understanding of academia, just because you might have learned about one indigenous perspective in all of your K through 12 and colleges and universities. Now you got people walking around pretending that academia is an inclusive, equity, justice-based place. No, academia is exactly like the white supremacy of the world, despite the world being 11% white. Academia, including sociology, is very much based on white people being in charge and white people being the determinants. And I'm saying this as a Black woman who created an academic program, operated the academic program for 9 years. I was one who selected the textbooks and hired faculty. I was in charge of annual program assessments for accreditation and in charge of helping libraries choose materials and get rid of false materials. So I know that this is possible, but I'm one of relatively few Black and Brown people around the world in white controlled spaces who are willing to not only tell white people this is what I'm gonna do, but also tell white people that if you aren't good with this, I'm still do this. And then we'll look at the outcomes as it is. Because white people bank on us being afraid of being controlled by white people and being fired from jobs. Yeah. And that's going to keep going on. Because if white people know you're not going to protest, if white people know you're going to go with the curriculum regardless, why should white people stop? This ain't about being kind and polite. This ain't about religion. This ain't about any of that stuff that grown adults keep falsifying. Yeah. It's not about any of that.
Yeah. So when you say when you were head of the department, you had to, you know, was looking at the books and seeing falsehoods. What specifically were you seeing that was troubling you that you felt you had to get rid of in order to improve the department or get the information that was actually telling the truth?
Well, I created a criminal studies academic program, and thankfully, my entire department was very much equity-based. So we all did this together. Me as the only Black woman, I did it from an angle that's also different in that as well. Mm-hmm. So what I would just see is, as a criminologist with a background in criminal justice, the idea was that most of the books you read were white people, and most of the time Black people were depicted, it was in terms of representation in particularly violent crime. Mm-hmm. It would be more difficult to address victimization such as sexual assault and so forth. So, I mean, there's so many disparities in terms of what's written and what's published, because most publishers are white people.
Yeah.
And this is around the world, including in Black and Brown nations. And so just different things that I noticed. And the things that I noticed as a faculty member are also things that I noticed back when I was a student. But no matter how much you write student evaluations, it still is up to the decision makers to determine if they want to make changes. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I tell people, changes are not easy. Like as a professor, when I made changes, and now with the work that I do with 365 Diversity, when I tell school decision makers, school officials for K-12 to make changes, this is not easy. The changes are not easy, okay? When we're telling you to stop using white people's version of math, we're telling you that if you can get a PhD in mathematics and still 99% of everything you read and learned was based on white people stuff,
yeah,
you can come from it literally believing that white men are the majority of authors and mathematicians in the world,
yep,
followed behind white women, despite, again, tens of thousands of years of indigenous math, Asian math, African math, yeah, and so forth. If you can come from that, that means that the decision makers, the accreditors, the people making standardized tests, also the people who are voting, paying taxes, many of them know that their decision matters more than the underrepresented and minoritized people's decisions. And it becomes complex because when we're talking about increasing women's knowledge, increasing LGBTQIA knowledge, increasing knowledge of people with disabilities and health conditions, we still have to highlight when we increase access to authors with disabilities and physical and mental conditions, we still have to make sure that that is not white dominated. Right. Because you can go through a whole entire conference with various publications from people with physical and mental conditions, and everyone is white still.
Yeah. I'm glad that you said that, because race still is that undercurrent that you have to, you know, be careful with. Like when you just talk about the disabilities and making sure that education needs to be diversified, different points of views need to come in, but you can still have, you know, you can still look at disability, social economic status, and it's still, like you say, can be dominated by white men. And that's not really the point of that. We need to kind of break free of that. And I like when you talk about mathematics, because there is this assumption that white people created math, you know, and that they were the ones that introduced it to the world, which if you know anything about history, you know that's not true. A great example mm-hmm. that I always think about is like Africa, West Africa, mm-hmm. prior to being colonialized, I want to say Timbuktu out in West Africa, you had scholars coming from the Arab world and different parts of Africa to go there mm-hmm. to be educated. Yep. You know, you had scholars who knew that, and they brought a lot of that information to Europeans.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of that knowledge, like even in Asia, like China, they created, I guess, their form of calculators, and they had math and science, and a lot of that filter over came over to Europe. But based on how we're set up here, you would never know that unless you, you know, someone told you or you decided to do some independent research. You'll think white men created all of that.
Followed by white women.
So followed by white women.
Again, highlight how we talk about white women and white men are the majority of K through 12 teachers, decision makers, and the majority of college university teachers and decision makers. So white women are right up there with that.
Oh yeah.
And when it comes to DEI equity work, white women are the most profitable, followed by black men and white men.
Yeah.
So white women intentionally, it's not like they're clueless, white women intentionally profit by the notion of victimization in terms of womanhood mm-hmm. while keeping the white power at the top. And then you can add, of course, sexuality if you're talking about white women who have various forms of sexualities and asexualities and health conditions. So this is all very deliberate. And colorism ties into racism. So when we talk about anti-blackness, anti-Asian, and tensions between black and brown people around the world, that also is based in 5 centuries of white terrorism.
Right.
And so oftentimes when people say, oh, we're going to make our curriculum more equity based, they will increase the visibility of light skin indigenous people, light skin Aboriginal, light skin Asians, mm-hmm. light skin Africans. Despite darker melanin being thousands of years around the world, the darkest of the most beautiful chocolate being in East India, white people will still intentionally select the lighter skin because the whole focus is to keep it white or white enough, which is why Egypt, the sciences, mm-hmm. the arts, the histories in Egypt, thousands of years, when you talk about Ankh and Hotep and the pyramids, now you have Egyptians led by white people and light-skinned Egyptians in particular saying, we are not Africa.
Oh, yeah.
Mind you, at the very top of the continent of Africa, with mm-hmm. various shades of people from all those continents, they're claiming that we're not really in Africa. And again, that's based in racism and colorism, because the more famous you get for science, the more you don't want to be African anymore. That's that whole acceptance into whiteness.
Or even when you talk about like Africa, and remember, Africa is a continent, people, is not a country. Mm-hmm. When everybody try to talk about African history, and I'm using air quotes here, they always talk about the Egyptian.
Yes.
And then that's it. As if that's all of Africa was what, as if all of Africa accomplishments happened in Egypt. That's it. They don't talk about nowhere else.
And then they'll talk about South Africa, apartheid, because again, that's highlighting European colonialism mm-hmm. and Christian missionaries. And then they'll mention areas where China has bought up space, including having Chinese restaurants in Nigeria where Nigerians are not allowed in the restaurant. In other words, the whole focus is to say, shut up, we're talking about Africa like you keep wanting, without us saying, but you're not really talking about the blackness of Africa as a continent for thousands of years.
Yep. Another really good example of that is the walls of Zimbabwe. And when white folks came there, white explorers came there, I mean, these walls and the civilization was very complex. It was amazing. And they refused to believe that the native people, the Shona, which are responsible, was the ones that created it. They thought that maybe another group of white people came that they didn't know about, built the walls. And this is in the heart of the continent. And they refuse to believe that Africans actually did this. That Africans have civilizations that are just as complex, even more so, empires, all these different things. And they just really kept trying to perpetuate that for the longest time, where it's like, no, Africans couldn't have built this. We refuse to believe that Africans had anything to do with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is where I hold Black people accountable, because 529 years of white terrorism, because again, white people created racial categories
yes.
to form the collective to control mm-hmm. people. 529 years of that requires compliance, complacence, and tokenism. And I call that's why daily I call out Black medical and health professionals, Black politicians, Black school teachers, Black school decision makers, Black DEI experts who yeah. are more focused on making money. Like the conversations we're having, it's very rare to find these conversations in spaces where Black people think that they will not be paid by white people.
Exactly.
And that's how Black people perpetuate this. I have these conversations everywhere I go because my work is based in centuries of knowledge that's based in thousands of years of African knowledge. It's not based on a white people's bestseller books. Mm-hmm. It's not based on white people's awards. It's not based on DEI, D&I acronyms. It's not based on anti-racism hashtags. It's not based on social media posts. It's literally based on centuries of work in which our people have been murdered, imprisoned, raped, stolen, and abused for doing real work that's not based on white approval, white permission. And I'm not the only Black person who does this work. My work is based in collaborations with other Black people who know the difference between collaboration and tokenism. And unfortunately, most Black people who do DEI work are not doing real work. They're getting paid.
That's true. I mean, the D&I, so there's times where people have tried to label me as a D&I, I guess, expert or subject person because of the work that I do. I don't really take that title. I don't claim it. A lot of D&I people that I've met, like you said, are people who are there for a check or the work that they do is very surface level because they don't really want to offend anybody. They want to alienate anyone. And so there's really nothing that ever happens. You know, it's very certain, like having like a Black History Month celebration or something like that. It's just very surface yeah. level. It's nothing systemic. Mm-hmm. It's never addressing anything. And so I always try to stay away from that label. I'm like, you mm-hmm. know, work that I do is advocacy. But I don't consider myself a D&I person or a subject matter expert. I don't right. claim it. And
me neither.
Like, yeah, I don't claim it. And then the people that I've seen do it, like you said, a lot of white women. I have a lot of issues. I'm very upfront with this. How do I say this? I don't trust white women. And a lot of Black women who I talk to, especially in the corporate side, will say the same thing. Maybe not as loud as I do, but yeah. they do because, and I give you a great example, and this has nothing to do with academia, but this is something that happened really recently. This happened with, it happened at ESPN. And by recent, by the time this episode aired, it probably won't be as recent, but at ESPN, this Black woman who's no longer there, her name is Maria Taylor. She's was a host. I think you already know the story. She was a host yeah. of sports clubs. And her white coworker, who was her, not necessarily her friend, but, you know, that was her coworker. They worked together. Her name was Rachel Nichols, I believe. And she was caught on camera talking about how she felt like this Black woman got her job because of affirmative action and how she wasn't really qualified. And she felt like the Black woman's ascension was coming at a cost to her. You know, she's right. losing spot. And I tell people, I said, this is one of the reasons why Black women do not trust white women, because white women are still white. They try to come with this whole feminism and we are equal, we're women, we're in it together, but that's not true. Mm-hmm. And she was caught saying it. She tried to backtrack, but you know, the damage was done. And you know, Maria, to her credit, decided to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's so many of them like that. In all, in academia, in corporate, whatever it is, it's just for me as a Black woman, I tend to keep white women just at arm's length. Like they're there, but I would rather work, if I had to work with anybody, in white men.
That's interesting because mm-hmm. that's the complexity of this, isn't it? Right?
Yeah.
Because as I explained to somebody, I did a podcast last night, and I explained to the podcast host that when I do this work, in addition to, of course, the battle with white men and white women, the battle, of course, with non-Black people in terms of brown people, because there's also battle with Black people in these spaces, because yeah. many of these Black people have built their education and their career mm-hmm. on convincing white people that they're Black enough for the diversity data, but not too Black that we're going to be making y'all do stuff.
Or making you uncomfortable.
Right. And it has also international implications, because there's a reason why medical schools and medical centers, for example, will hire Black people around the world before they hire Black people born and raised as descendants of transatlantic slavery. Because the idea is to have the data for Black people, but to also have Black people who don't really perhaps see this as pro-Black movement from a Western Hemisphere perspective. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times when I do this work, it's often the Black people who defend and protect white people. And especially the white people cry in my work, because mm-hmm. people have gotten so accustomed to using white people's dictionary definitions, using abstract terminology. But the abstract terminology only happens when we're talking about race and ethnicity. So when we're talking about, because I'm a staunch advocate for LGBTQIA rights, particularly Black and brown LGBTQIA, yeah. no matter where I go, I can specify critiquing and dismantling the power of cisgender heterosexuals. Mm-hmm. When I talk about gender equity, I specify dismantling cisgender power and boys and men power as pertains to gender identity. When I'm talking about wealth, dismantling the wealthy, you know, removing the class divide, health, all that things, you're specifying. But when it comes to race, we're supposed to talk abstract. Like yeah. people need to be better to each other. Anyone can be racist, pretending that racism is synonymous with prejudice and discrimination. It's yeah. not. Yeah. The dictionary says that because it's made by white people yeah. to make sure it doesn't offend white people. Sociologists mm-hmm. for centuries, Black sociologists have clearly explained the difference between racism, prejudice and discrimination, and something that's lasting for centuries in literally every part of our lives.
Yeah.
And so I just always highlight that, because it's when we do the racial based work that people want you to be abstract, as if we're not talking about white people.
Yeah, it's the All Lives Matter approach is you know, they don't want to get specific. Like for me, when I talk about who my work is for, who is aimed for, I don't use the phrase people of color. I, no. over the years, have really moved away from that. I don't That's right. like that term. Right. It's just too general. It's too soft. It's not direct. And so I don't say, you know, my podcast, my platform is for people of color. No, it's for Black people.
Yeah. And I'm not of color, because we used to be called colored. Yeah. So I'm not going to adopt no of color acronyms or phrases.
I just don't like that phrase. And I'm just like, my stuff is for Black folks. And yep. if other people want to rock with it and they want to listen and whatever and follow along, fine. But my subject matter and who I talk about and my work is for Black people. Right. Because that whole people of color term, it just sweeps everybody's issues under the rug. And it always comes at a cost to Black people.
Yes, like, because then the focus becomes everyone else. And then Black people, as a collective, Black people are very supportive. We work mm-hmm. to dismantle anti-Asian violence. We work mm-hmm. to dismantle anti-Indigenous violence, anti-Hispanic, anti-Latin violence. But when it comes to us for yeah. centuries, you can only find very few photos and very few writings from non-Black people.
Yep.
And thankfully there are brown people around the world who work to dismantle that. But they say dismantling this first requires being honest about the reality of centuries of this. And so that's one of the difficulties when doing the work that you and I both are doing. We're not just saying we want honest dialogue, because we know how to have honest dialogue. We're now holding people accountable for doing the work. And doing this work in schools, I always tell people when they contact me for my services, I tell them I'm results-based, which means you're not going to have a 2-hour training with me. And the only thing you get from this is, how do you define racism? How can we get along better? Yeah. To me, that is so K-12, and we're not going to waste the lives of people who really need to dismantle injustices and inequities. You're mm-hmm. going to come from this. I tell people, before you get to me, you're going to already have read what I'm giving you right now based on centuries of scholarship. You're not going to come to me and say, can you define racism? Because we're not wasting time on that.
Right.
Instead, I'm saying, what are your policies? What are your practices? I don't believe in bias training, so I'm not going to waste time talking about your biases. You are welcome to hold on to those. What we're talking about is measurable results, so that your bias can never translate into actions exactly. that harm underserved people. Exactly. And it's always important, because I always have to specify when I do this work, including for medical and health professionals, it's very common. They want me to come in and speak abstract. And the moment I say white people, you hear the white people in the background saying, yeah. Well, what if I said black people? I says, well, if black people were in control of medicine and health around the world and pretended that white people created medicine and health, then you could say that, but that's not what happened. So therefore do not use that comparison and attempt to distract me.
Oh.
And most white people are not accustomed to being told exactly what needs to be told. White people are accustomed to black people talking behind their backs. And those of us for centuries who say it exactly like it is in their faces are the ones punished. Yeah. So whenever people say we want honest dialogue, I always push it back and say, do you really want honest dialogue, or do you want dialogue that is comfortable for white liberals and white conservatives? Because that's not how I operate. That's yeah. not collaboration. That's not unity. That's not reaching a larger goal together. So the same way people criticize Biden for compromising with Republicans, I tell people, you're criticizing Biden for that, but you do that every day in your schools, every day mm-hmm. in your business, mm-hmm. every day in your organization, every day in your community. So Biden is just reiterating the 529 years of white power that you reiterate every day in your life. And you have yeah. tons of excuses.
Yeah. Truth is not something that is held in high regard.
Yes.
You know, and I always say, like, one of the things that get a lot of black women in trouble is that truth and directness is more of the love language that we have. And so a lot of times when you're dealing with white people, especially who are not accustomed to that, they think you're being rude and they think that you are, you know, you're not being fair or what have you, because culturally speaking, they're not accustomed to that. And you right. see it not just in academia, you even see it in social interactions. I've seen white women compliment each other on, for example, clothes, and then they'll leave and be like, oh, you know, that was actually really ugly. I didn't like that. I'm like, then why yeah. did you tell her that you liked it then? You know, I'm like, yeah. why be faking her faith? And you take that small example and then you blow it up and you see it, and you see it how it plays out even in larger scales. It's how the truth is something that they don't want. They want you to tell them what they need, what they want to hear, so that they can yep. feel better about themselves.
Yeah. And that's exactly why I tell school officials and school teachers and principals of schools mm-hmm. that when you do professional development trainings or anything where you're saying you want to change, you have to ask yourself, are the decision makers here being told that they have to make changes? Because if the employees will show up regardless and comply regardless, nothing's going to change. Mm-hmm. And this is so prevalent that now I hold all school teachers and all school officials and school principals accountable. Because again, nothing changes if you're gonna show up for work and use the same horrible textbooks as always.
Yep.
If you're gonna show up for work and use the same testing standards as always, if you're going to comply regardless, again, the power majority, and that's white people as pertains to race, will not stop what they're doing. And so this is where I also tell school teachers to stop teaching lies to children. In addition to the lies and inaccuracies in the books, there's also lies and inaccuracies when school officials and school teachers tell children to shoot for the moon and you'll be one of the stars, or the future is up to you and knowledge yeah. is power. Like, yeah. why are you telling them that when you are a grown adult who knows you're teaching them falsehoods in textbooks and falsehoods in standardized tests mm-hmm. and falsehoods from accreditation agencies and politicians? You're doing that for your career and you say you need to pay bills. So why do you have the hypocrisy and the audacious audacity to be an inspirational, motivational speaker for children?
Yeah, it's always that, you know, I remember that they used to say that too. You can be anything you want to be and, you know, shoot for the stars. And if you don't get the stars, at least you'll land on the moon. Some frivolous like, nonsense. And yeah. it's just not real life anyway. You can't be you can be anything you want to be. You can't be anything you want to be. Like, That's kind of the harsh truth of the world. And I remember this comedian, he was like, when you go to community college, that's where dreams are narrowed down. He was like, that's just not real. We teach our children that, but we don't, first of all, we don't equip them to be able to be anything they want to be, just for a variety of different factors. And like you said, people are teaching things that are not true, just because they have to, or for political and social reasons as well. But one of the things that I wanted to talk with you about was critical race theory, this whole thing now that has become a controversy for various reasons. I don't pretend to know everything, so that's why I wanted you to talk about it, kind of what it is. How do you feel about it, first of all? Do you think that it should be? If not, why? And then why are some people having issues with this, as from your perspective?
All right, so I'm one of those Black activist scholars who will not waste time explaining critical race theory. Okay. And here's why. Critical race theory was presented in the 1980s, mm-hmm. particularly from Black scholars, activist scholars, Black theorists, and particularly who teach in law schools, and it's based in centuries of Black knowledge. I do not explain critical race theory now because I don't go based on what white people are interested in any given moment.
Yeah.
These things have existed for generations, and I don't believe that Black knowledge needs to only be discussed when white people are now interested, and that applies to white liberals as well. So whenever people ask me usually it started 2016, 2021, when people ask me to explain it, I tell Black people, well, I'm gonna send you some readings, because discussions and explanations like this are essentially based on, well, maybe we should learn now because white people are interested. And I don't believe
in, yeah.
I don't mm-hmm. believe in ever developing Black sharing of knowledge based on what white people are suddenly concerned about and suddenly outraged about. However, I will just say that critical race theory, a lot of people are saying, you know, Karl Marx, conflict theory. First of all, Karl Marx was a sociologist, but that's also the very white man foundation of sociology, because Karl Marx was not the first person ever to address uprisings and protests. Again, that's also thousands of years of knowledge and scholarship. Marx is well known for doing that work, but he also was in his own right an armchair theorist. He died poor intentionally to prove a point about anti-capitalism, but he wasn't really out there in the trenches doing these uprisings for the working class. So I want to highlight that. And so when we talk about critical race theory, we want to understand, again, when we're talking about the legal perspective, how race and racism are not synonymous. Like I'm Pan-African, pro-Black, staunch Black gender equity warrior. I do all of that. But when I talk about my racial identity and my racial pride, it's not synonymous with racism and oppression. So I don't think about white people all day, every day.
Right.
And I always have to explain that even to college students, because most Black college students, all they know about Blackness is oppression. And all they know about oppression is like Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Martin Luther King, that kind of thing. They don't know like all the scholarship. Yeah. So when you look at critical race theory, the foundation of that is looking at the structural institutional inequities in the legal system, in the law code, in policies and practices, and of course, how that shapes the definition of crime and how that shapes how crimes are responded to and punished. Mm-hmm. And that also shapes legally, that shapes everything about law schools as well. Mm-hmm. So when undergrad, I was pre-law. I worked at a law school dean's office during the O.J. Simpson trial. It was working at the law school dean's office during the O.J. Simpson trial and seeing the white women law school deans come in crying because O.J. Simpson was acquitted that actually made me decide, despite being pre-law, it made me decide instead of going to law school, I wanted to go into criminal justice, which is what I did. And I went, got the master's in criminal justice. And so these are all just examples of the components of critical race theory itself. Mm-hmm. It is a legal approach from Black activist scholars particularly, and it's strongly connected to overall Black social science, which is the foundation of Black sociology, Black criminology. Among the first well-known Black sociologists and Black criminologists is Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. Yeah. And so So when we talk about what is critical race theory, I always want people to understand the foundation, because there's literally tons of writings based on critical race theory since the 1980s that you can access it. It's publicly accessible, and it should never be based on whether white people are interested at any given moment.
I'm glad you said that. So yeah. it's been here. The work has already been done. This is just now. It feels like a fad that is happening right now.
It's a white people fad. And the sad part is most Black people, and here's the thing, we have tens of thousands of years of trillions of people, billions of concepts, billions of theories, billions of research and books. No one is ever going to know every theory. So not ever having heard of critical race theory does not dismantle your Blackness. Many Black sociologists, including elder Black sociologists who have done sociology for more than 60 years, have never heard of critical race theory. Not because they discard the theory, but because the theory is very similar to other Black theories from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. So it's not a disrespect to the critical race theorists. Instead, it's saying this all connects such that we want to understand how this relates and not compete over which one you know more. So that's just, you know, basic understanding of how this all goes together. As for why people are outraged, and when I say people, that's white people, white enough people, and token sellouts. Yep. They're outraged because, again, everything is supposed to be controlled by white people. First of all, there's no such thing as a K-12 that teaches critical race theory. Even most college university classrooms like sociology, pre-law, most law schools do not teach critical race theory. It's a theory, which means that it's just like any other theory. Like I can think about my dissertation chair's theory. His theory is not used in every criminology and sociology class either. So it's a theory. So when people say it's everywhere, that's this based on white people. Whenever you tell white people know about one thing, white people pretend that thousands of years are based on, you know, white people being harmed, despite whiteness not existing, but for 500 years. Yeah. So that's just the overreaction. And, you know, you can look at that from a racial threat perspective as well. What does it mean when white people feel even remote challenges to white dominance? Because white people are accustomed, and this is regardless of political party, to white people being in control, even if there's no white people in the space. The idea is that the books, the knowledge, the information, the language we use, like we're using, you know, a derivative of English from the British, you know, the way we dress. And it's not just a USA and Canada thing. When you go to Jamaica, Haiti, even though, of course, Haitian uprising against the French, when you go to Africa, you can still find this work in libraries. It's white people. You can still find, you know, African judges wearing British wigs. I mean,
yes, you can. It's everywhere. It is everywhere. Right. Whiteness. Yep.
Yep. So K-12 is not using critical race theory. So people who are mad are, again, white people who are not accustomed to being in control of everything. And this is why I also hold teachers accountable. I really expect bare minimum from school officials now at this point, because I think that they're really based on politics. And when school officials, including most Black and brown school officials, when they say they want to help Black and brown communities and help Black and brown students, they really mean that theoretically, because at the end of the day, if they put a policy or practice in place and suddenly white people express outrage, whether that's anonymously via email or at a school board meeting, most Black and brown school officials will reverse their decision, because regardless of what they say, the real people whose opinions and outrage matters are white people.
Yeah.
And this is white people across the political party. So the same thing applies to critical race theory. So this is where I hold the onus on teachers who really want to teach about racial equity. Do not be stuck on critical race theory itself, because critical race theorists do not want you using one theory as an escape. You can teach about racial equity and racial inequities without even mentioning any theory. We have done this work for centuries in which we have never said, we've never said conflict theory. We've never said, as Du Bois said in Double Consciousness, that's not said in K-12, but yet Black students, I'm a product of predominantly Black, rich, and public schools. We learn certain aspects of all of this without having to mention a theory. So I want teachers to stop using white outrage over theory as an excuse. Teachers are scared to change the curriculum. They want to do a change books hashtag where they add one book, but they're not changing the entire curriculum. They're not demanding that dominance of white people's version of everything is removed. So when they're talking about protesting about critical race theory, I tell them to sit your butt down somewhere and work on changing the entire curriculum instead of using one theory as a distraction from your lack of, you know, diligence in changing other stuff.
Exactly.
So this is just all things. So whenever people say, you know, will we ever be able to nap critical race theory? I'm like, seriously, why do you care about that one theory?
Yeah.
Instead of spending your time saying, here are the books that we need to use. Here are the books that we need to remove from the libraries. Here's the accreditation requirements that are horrible. You know, there's really real work to be done. And there are Black people and brown people who specialize in this, and we can help you do it. But instead, too many school officials and too many school teachers want to distract us by talking about a theory or a politician. And the same thing happens with anti-Trump rhetoric. I don't care about any of these politicians. I want to see what people who make decisions in schools are going to do. And I'm not distracted. This is not like a puppy looking in the sky anymore. Like, enough of that nonsense. What are we doing for real, for real?
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you for that, because that is the 100% truth. This work has been around. You know, it does feel very much like a fad as opposed to something that people really want to do. And we got to get away from that. So I want to thank you very much for talking about it, because it was a subject that I'm interested in. I didn't know enough about it. You came in and you laid it out. So I appreciate that. So in the interest of time, you know, I really want to thank you for, again, being on the show, for always coming and giving your knowledge and your unfiltered opinion. I think that's very important, having these conversations and breaking it down like that. So once again, where can folks find you if they want to work with you or learn more about the things that you do?
Again, thank you for having me. You can find me at 365diversity.com. My contact information is up there. And again, the work I do, I myself am a theorist. I created theory courses for college students. I taught them. All that fun stuff. But the work I do is far beyond concepts, ideas, and theories. So if you think that you can contact me and say, let's discuss this, I'm not discussing anything else with grown folks. Yep. You all have had enough conversations. Now it's time to say, what are you really doing? And especially the people who make all the decisions. If the people who make the decisions are not doing what they should be doing, the question falls back on you. Why are you complying to their non-compliance? We need more than you, you know, being armchair theorists, armchair activists. And I have a disability, so you don't have to be marching down the streets to protest. There's other forms of protest, including financial protests, including teachers who say, look, I have expertise beyond this one school, beyond this one school district. In other words, the oppressors and the horrible decision makers are going to keep doing what they do. So I need you all to do more than contact me and say, thank you for your work. Because I'm going to throw it back at you and say, okay, now what are you doing? Because I know my work is not needed. As a Black woman, I don't need any more compliments. You know, I want Black women to be confident in our work. We know what we're doing, but we're not just doing this to gas ourselves up. To look in the mirror, like, I'm awesome. We are literally doing work to help people. We're sacrificing our careers. We have white people stalking us daily. We're sacrificing for a larger purpose. So what are you doing for this purpose besides complimenting us and hashtagging, besides having one extra book in a class? We need more than that. And you already know that. So I don't even have to tell you that.
Exactly. 100%. Enough talk. Let's get the work done. So again, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing and, you know, really being that person that we can all go to. So definitely we'll have you back on again, you know, always. always appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Well, that's it. Thank you for listening. Questions or comments, please visit our website, www.blackmissintheworkplace.com, and let us know. And also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and of course, LinkedIn. Until next episode, stay focused and stay centered. Peace and love.